Exodus chapter 12, verses 1 to 41. The 15th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on September 18, 2016, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 13, Exodus 12, 1-41, accompanies this talk.
We've talked about the plagues as a whole. We did that last week and the week before that. So now it comes to the 10th and final plague. We're going to talk about it. That's the most important one. That's the climax of the plague narrative. And that's the one that the Bible spends the most time on. It's the most significant for a number of reasons. We're going to go through most of chapter 12. The chapter is complex. And the reason that it's complex is the author is trying to accomplish a couple of purposes all mixed together. One of those purposes is the author wants to establish the Passover as a permanent ordinance. That is, this is something that's going to be celebrated annually. The other thing that the author is doing is telling the Israelites what they're supposed to be doing right now at this moment. So these two are mixed together, and it's a little bit difficult to tease out when he's talking about the permanent celebration that's being established and when he's just talking about the instructions that are being given to the Israelites at this time. Exodus 12, verses 1 through 13. Now the Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, "This month shall be the beginning of months for you. It is to be the first month of the year to you. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, 'On the 10th of this month, they are each one to take a lamb for themselves, according to their father's households, a lamb for each household.' Now if the household is too small for a lamb, then he and his neighbor nearest to his house are to take one according to the number of persons in them, according to what each man should eat. You are to divide the lamb. Your lamb shall be an unblemished male, a year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats, and you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month, when the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel is to kill it at twilight. Moreover, they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses in which they eat it. And they shall eat the flesh that same night, roasted with fire, and they shall eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. Do not eat any of it raw or boiled at all with water, but rather roasted with fire, both its head and its legs along with its entrails. And you shall not leave any of it over until morning, but whatever is left of it until morning you shall burn with fire. Now you shall eat it in this manner: with your loins girded, your sandals on your feet, your staff in your hand, and you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. For I will go through the land of Egypt on that night, and I will strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast. And against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. And the blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you live. And when you see the blood, I will pass over you, and no plague will befall you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt." So he's establishing this as an annual commemoration of this event. I'll talk more about this later, but from God's perspective, it is critical that the people of Israel remember this thing that God did. Remember the Passover, and remember the Exodus. I would argue that those are among a handful of events in the history of Israel that are most important. It says that he gave these instructions to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt. The rabbis take that to mean that these instructions were specific to this event, to this Passover. It's called the Egyptian Passover. And what they argue is, this is the only time the Passover was celebrated exactly like this. When it's commemorated after that, there are a few adjustments that are made, and we'll talk about those later. Apparently, the best I can make sense of this In the chapter before, when Moses spoke to Pharaoh and said this is going to happen at midnight, the best sense I can make of this is he didn't specify at midnight on which day. So it's probably a few days that pass, maybe a couple weeks that pass between the time that Moses spoke to Pharaoh and when the Passover actually takes place. But I'm not sure of that. And it says then that this commemoration is going to take place at the beginning of the year. It says, this month shall be the beginning of months for you. So this is happening, if tradition is right, this happens in April or March. It's happening in the spring, and what God is saying is, this will mark the beginning of the year of your calendar. And you probably know that Rosh Hashanah, New Year's Day, is coming up pretty soon. I think it's October 2nd this year. That's New Year's. It's not in April or March. But when God says that this will be the beginning of the year, I think he's specifically talking about the beginning of the year of your religious calendar. We all have different calendars for different purposes. Our year begins in January for most purposes, but the academic year begins in September. People's fiscal year, it can begin any time. Like Gutenberg, it began in, it's September 1st. So there are different calendars for different purposes. What's being established here is the calendar for religious purposes, for the purposes of the celebration of the feasts. So this is going to be the beginning in March or April. And what I'm going to argue as we proceed through Exodus is I think that these feasts are a recapitulation of the events in Exodus. The feasts are, the first one is Passover, but there are three feasts that are all kind of in one in the Jewish calendar. It's Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which we'll get to in just a minute, and the Feast of First Fruits, which is in the next chapter. Passover occurs on the first day of the week. The Feast of Unleavened Bread is that whole 7 days beginning with Passover. And the Feast of First Fruits, it's difficult to figure out where it is exactly in the calendar, but it appears to be 2 or 3 days into the week. The next, and this is the first of three times when, in later Jewish history, the Jews are all supposed to come to Jerusalem to celebrate these feasts. Wherever they are in Israel or Judea, they're supposed to come to Jerusalem and celebrate these feasts in Jerusalem. So the first is this Passover week. The second is Shavuot, which is in the middle of the summer. We call it Pentecost. And then the third is Sukkot, which is another group of three feasts. It's Sukkot, it's Yom Kippur, and those are all three, and that's another one-week celebration, well, Sukkot is. So we've got three feasts clustered in the spring, one in the summer, and then three clustered in the fall. So that's the calendar, and what I'm going to argue is I think then that these feasts are tied to events in Exodus in the order in which they occur in Exodus. So what's being required then of the Jewish people is that they recapitulate the whole Exodus process annually. Okay, they're supposed to start on the 10th of the month. So the month begins with the new moon. It's a modified lunar calendar. The month begins with the new moon. So on the 15th, you have a full moon. So on the 10th day of the month, they are supposed to select out the animal that they're going to use for Passover. They select it out and they isolate it. And it becomes clear later that the reason for that is to make sure that this animal stays clean. They've got it isolated so it isn't exposed to anything that's dead, etc. There are various ways that it can become unclean. But if they isolate it, they can watch it and make sure that it does not become unclean. So on the 10th, it's taken out, separated out, and it's observed for the next 4 days until Passover happens. If a household is too small to consume a whole lamb, then they're supposed to combine with their neighbors so that there are enough people to eat the whole lamb. And as we'll see, it's important that that happen. It can be either a sheep or a goat. The only requirement is that it be a one-year-old male and without blemish. Then, on the 14th day at twilight is when the animal is supposed to be killed. The animal's killed, sacrificed, and blood is supposed to be taken from this animal, and it is supposed to be painted with hyssop on the lintel of the door and the two doorposts. Then they are to have a meal of eating this animal, and it is very specific. It needs to be cooked by roasting it. It can't be boiled. It can't be eaten raw. It has to be roasted. Sarna speculates that it was supposed to be roasted because it has to be done quickly. Well, it could be eaten raw, and that'd be pretty quick. But roasting gets rid of the blood is another thing that Sarna points out. I don't know why the requirement that it be roasted. My suspicion is that it has to do with fire. Fire is an image in the Old Testament of complete purification or judgment, it can be. And my suspicion is that there's some kind of connotation there that's important. I think that's why it has to be roasted. It is to be eaten with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. And that becomes a part of the Passover tradition. The unleavened bread, in recollection of the fact that this had to be done quickly, couldn't even wait for the bread to rise. And bitter herbs, in recollection of the fact that they were coming out of slavery, they were coming out of bitter slavery. The whole animal needs to be consumed, every bit of it, head, legs, and entrails. And apparently, it's all to be eaten. None of it's supposed to be left over. If there are any leftovers at all, those are to be burned up. And apparently, the reason for that is that the sacrificial animal is completely devoted to its purpose, and so it all has to be consumed in one way or another. Okay, so they've cooked the lamb. They've sat down to eat it. They are supposed to sit there and eat it, ready to go. They're dressed. They have their sandals on. They've got their staff in hand, stressing the fact that there is this great urgency. Now, why are they supposed to do this? Why are they supposed to kill this lamb, put the blood on the doorposts, eat it, ready to go? It's because God is going to come in and he's going to kill all of the firstborn in every household where the door is not painted with the blood of a sacrifice. So in all the Egyptian households, the firstborn will die. And it's not only firstborn children, but it's firstborn animals as well. They will die also. So only the Israelites will be spared, and they will be spared on the basis of the lintel being painted with the blood of the paschal sacrifice. It says, as I mentioned last week, this is a judgment against all the gods of Egypt, that he's executing these judgments. I take this to mean that it is a judgment against the whole Egyptian religious system, more generally than just the gods. And I talked about that last week. God, through this, is going to demonstrate that he alone is the master of the universe. He alone is the God in control, and that's Yahweh. Okay, but he won't strike the houses marked with blood. The next section, 14 to 22. Now this day will be a memorial to you, and you shall celebrate it as a feast to the Lord. Throughout your generations, you are to celebrate it as a permanent ordinance. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. But on the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses. For whoever eats anything leavened from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. And on the first day you shall have a holy assembly, and another holy assembly on the seventh day. No work at all shall be done on them, except what must be eaten by every person. That alone may be prepared by you. You shall also observe the feast of unleavened bread, for on this very day I brought your hosts out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as a permanent ordinance. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening. 7 days there shall be no leaven found in your houses, for whoever eats what is leavened, that person shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he is an alien or a native of the land. You shall not eat anything leavened. In all your dwellings you shall eat unleavened bread. Then Moses called for all the elders of Israel and said to them, go and take for yourselves lambs according to your families and slay the Passover lamb. And you shall take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood which is in the basin and apply some of the blood that is in the basin to the lintel and the two doorposts. And none of you shall go outside the door of his house until morning. So establishing another feast, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, these coincide. This one is not just one day, it's 7 days. And it's during these 7 days that they are not supposed to eat anything leavened. And in fact, they're supposed to go through the house before this begins and make sure that they have removed every bit of leaven that's in the house. And they're supposed to do that for 1 week. There is supposed to be an holy assembly on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and there's supposed to be a holy assembly on the last day. So the first and the last day, then, are true Sabbaths. The days in between are also considered Sabbath days. That is to say, work is not to be done. But, and there's a term, and I don't remember what the term is, but I'll call it a soft Sabbath. That is to say, it's not as strict on the days in between, because it says, no work at all shall be done on them, except what must be eaten by every person, that alone may be prepared by you. So you can do the work of preparing food on those 5 days that are in between the two Sabbaths at the ends. Does that make sense? In Israel today, it's looser than that. There are other things that can be done on those 5 days in between the two full Sabbaths. Why will it be celebrated? It says, because on this very day I brought your hosts out of the land of Egypt. I brought your hosts, that's a military term. So I brought your troops out of Egypt at that time. That's why this is being celebrated, because God brought them out of Egypt, brought them out of slavery. The fact that that's a military term, I'll come back to that later. When will it be celebrated? This is the first month of the year. On the 15th day is when it will begin, and it goes for 1 week. So the first day coincides with Passover. Now, what it says is, if you don't, that person shall be cut off from Israel. Shall be cut off. That phrase is never explained in the Old Testament. It's never explained what it means that that person shall be cut off. It occurs 36 times in the Old Testament, and in 35 of those cases, it is in the passive voice, and it's impersonal, so we don't know who's doing the cutting off. But there is one instance in Leviticus 20, verses 1 through 6, where it's active voice, and the subject is God. So it would appear that this cutting off is not a punishment that's to be carried out by the society, but this is something that God himself does. God will do the cutting off. So anyone who does not participate in this feast, God is the one who will cut them off from Israel. Okay, verse 21 then, Moses then calls all the elders of Israel and he says, go do what you've been told to do. Go and take the lamb, each lamb, kill the lamb, paint the doorposts with the blood, and stay in your house. Don't come out at all during this night. Next section, verse 23. For the Lord will pass through to smite the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to smite you. And you shall observe this event as an ordinance for you and your children forever. And it will come about when you enter the land, which the Lord will give you, as he has promised, that you shall observe this rite. And it will come about when your children will say to you, what does this rite mean to you? That you shall say, it is a Passover sacrifice to the Lord who passed over the houses of the sons of Israel in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians but spared our homes. And the people bowed low and worshipped. Then the sons of Israel went and did so, just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. So Moses explains to the people of Israel that God will pass over those houses which have the blood on the lintel, but in the houses of the Egyptians that don't have the blood, he is going to smite the firstborn. And it says again in verse 24, you shall observe this event as an ordinance for you and your children forever. The fact that this is a permanent ordinance is stressed. This is the third time it's been mentioned, and it'll be mentioned again. Clearly, this is an important event, something that has to be kept in the mind of the culture of the people of Israel forever. That's what God has intended. In verse 25, and it says, and it will come about when you enter the land, which the Lord will give you, as he has promised, that you shall observe this rite. There is only one instance recorded in the Old Testament after this initial Passover celebration where the Passover is celebrated. That's 1 year later, the Israelites in the wilderness celebrate the Passover. After that, we have no mention of the Passover being celebrated until they cross the River Jordan and enter into the land. And the rabbis point to this phrase, when you enter the land, as the explanation for that. That what they were told by God is that this commemoration is to be done when, after you have entered the land, then it needs to become an annual event. Your children will ask, what does this rite mean to you? And they are supposed to respond to that and explain what the Passover is, that a sacrifice was made to God. And because of that sacrifice, then the houses of the people of Israel were passed over. That is, the firstborn in those houses were spared. So what God is wanting to do is keep the memory of this event alive in Jewish culture. Because generations are going to come along that didn't experience it, but their parents did. And their parents are supposed to tell what happened, pass that on to their children, along with the ceremony that accompanies it, and they then, in turn, are supposed to pass it on to their children, etc. So this is a very important piece of history that we have eyewitnesses to, and they are supposed to pass on that account to the next generations who don't have the opportunity to actually experience it themselves. At that point, the people bowed low and worshipped and did just as they had been commanded to do by Moses and Aaron. Verse 29, now it came about at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of cattle. And Pharaoh arose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was no home where there was not someone dead. Then he called for Moses and Aaron at night and said, rise up, get out from among my people, both you and the sons of Israel, and go worship the Lord as you have said. Take both your flocks and your herds as you have said, and go and bless me also. So midnight comes, and the angel of death is passing over Egypt, and in the houses of the Egyptians, the firstborn is killed. So you can imagine, as soon as that's discovered by the household, that the firstborn is dead now, that there would be crying. I mean, it would be extreme sense of loss and sadness. They're probably vocal about it, and they hear their neighbors doing the same thing. So there's cries of lamentations going up all over the place. And even Pharaoh is affected by it. Probably hears the outcries. Maybe his firstborn is also killed. His servants' firstborn are killed. It says there was no home where there was not someone dead. So this is happening everywhere. You can imagine how distressing that would be. So they turn to Pharaoh and are insisting, Pharaoh, you've got to get rid of these Israelites. You've got to get rid of these Hebrews. Look at all the devastation that's resulted from them being here. Let them go. And Pharaoh finally relents, and he calls for Moses and Aaron at night. Earlier, Pharaoh said, if I see you again, you're a dead man. When it says that he called for Moses and Aaron, that doesn't necessarily mean that Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh. It's possible that they came to Pharaoh. If they did, then Pharaoh's threat was an empty threat. But it's possible that Moses and Aaron didn't actually show up in person, that he just appealed to them. In any case, he says to them, get up and get out of here. Take your people and go. And he says, you can even take your flocks. If you'll recall, that was the last thing, bargaining chip that he had held on to. He'd said, oh, you can go, but leave your flocks. And Moses said, no, it's all or nothing. And so now Pharaoh's saying, it's all. You can go. You can take your flocks, but get out of here. And then the last phrase here is such a haunting phrase to me. It says, and bless me also. Pharaoh's saying, and bless me also. And I'll talk about that later. Verse 33, and the Egyptians urged the people to send them out of the land in haste, for they said, we shall be dead. So the people took their dough before it was leavened, with their kneading bowls bound up in the clothes on their shoulders. Now the sons of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, for they had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they let them have their request. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. So the Egyptians at this point, and I think it says the Egyptians urged the people to send them out of the land in haste, for they said, I think what's happening here is the Egyptians is a phrase that's being used to refer to the high-ranking officials, that these high-ranking officials are urging the people, and I assume that's the Egyptian people, but it could be the Israelites, to send them out of the land in haste, for they said, we shall all be dead. So they've reached the point where they see that this is disastrous. Having the Hebrews stay in their midst has already been very painful for about 7 or 8 months, and now this tops it all. This is all of this death, and they say, we've had it. The Hebrews have to go. So Pharaoh is in a position where he really has no choice. Everyone wants the Hebrews out of Egypt, and Pharaoh alone is in no position to keep them from going. So the people of Israel pack up. They take their dough, they take their kneading bowls, they just pack it all up, and they take off. They take with them the articles of silver and gold and clothing that they had asked for from the Egyptians. If you'll recall, God had told them to ask for things from their Egyptian masters. And God disposed the Egyptians to be inclined to give them stuff. And so the Israelites are gathering all this stuff together, and that's part of what they take. And it says then, thus they plundered the Egyptians. So again, plundered is a military term. And I really think that this is all, their departure from Egypt is being depicted as a military conquest. There wasn't any fighting, but nevertheless, this is a conquest of the Egyptians, a conquest of Pharaoh. And I think that's why the word plundered is used here. They are plundering the Egyptians like a conquering army plunders. They just didn't have to use violence to get it. Verse 37, now the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Sukkot, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from children. And a mixed multitude also went up with them, along with flocks and herds, a very large number of livestock. And they baked the dough which they had brought out of Egypt into cakes of unleavened bread, for it had not become leavened since they were driven out of Egypt and could not delay, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. Now, there's a lot that we could talk about in these, three verses. I'm going to be talking about the route of the Exodus more next week. I think I get to it next week. And it's hard to sort that out, but there is a hypothesis that can be ventured. But Sukkot, so they're going from Ramses to Sukkot. Sukkot, the word means tents. It's the Hebrew word for tents. We don't know where it was located for sure. It appears to have been a region rather than a city. But it appears to have been a region on the edge of Egypt that separates Egypt from the Sinai. And apparently it was named Sukkot because this was a favorite gathering place for people migrating down from Canaan into Egypt or these nomads leaving Egypt on their way to Canaan, this is the stopping point on the edge of the frontier. And it's called Sukkot because it's full of tents where these nomadic peoples are staying for a few days. So they go from Ramses to this area, Sukkot, which is right on the border between Egypt and the Sinai Desert. It says about 600,000 men on foot. And the word that's used for men here is fighting men. So it's 600,000 soldiers, essentially, warriors. 600,000 is a lot. If that's the number of fighting men, and you want to calculate how many total people there were, at this time in history, a rough estimate would be to multiply that by 4. So a wife and 2 kids, on average. So we're getting up, that's a lot, plus a few 100,000. And others have argued, and I think it is absolutely the case, that large a number just cannot work in the narrative. If you have that many people, I'll just use one example. If you have that many people, as they go to enter the promised land, why are they afraid? They would outnumber the whole population of Canaan by about 3 times. There are a number of reasons why this number just will not make sense in the narrative. And as a result, this is a large number in the Old Testament being problematic is not only found here. It's found elsewhere in the Old Testament. And people have worked on this, tried to figure out what's going on here, and I'm confident that there's some misunderstanding. Either that or the texts have been corrupted, but I think it's more likely that there's been a misunderstanding. And the suggestion that's been made that I think is most reasonable is that the word thousand, elef, in Hebrew, can mean a commander. It can also mean a unit of troops or a troop, like a battalion or whatever. It is possible that at some point in history that the standard unit, military unit, was 1,000 men, and that's how elef came to be used for that term. But over time, it changed. As I thought of a couple of examples, a 2x4 used to be 2x4. The English pound used to be a pound. It's slivers of a pound now. So that kind of thing can happen. And in any case, however it came to be, it makes much more sense that what's being said here is there were 600 troops, there were 600 platoons of fighting men that left Egypt. If that's the case, then we're talking about a much smaller number. And Colin Humphreys, in his book, tries to figure out what would be, from other evidence in the Pentateuch, he calculates a number, and he comes up to a number between 20 and 30,000. And others have weighed in on that and think that that's a very reasonable number given the evidence that we do have. So that's more likely what we're working with is 20 to 30,000, and that's total people that left Egypt. They're going also with their livestock, which is a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in that they get food, they get milk, they get various products from their livestock that will be important as the years unfold and getting started when they get into the promised land. But that's going to slow them down. That's going to make things a lot harder, especially at this the beginning when they're trying to get away quickly. They've got their dough with them, which is not leavened because it didn't have time to rise, and they didn't have time to make other provisions, so they're just leaving. They're going on the fly. Okay, last two verses. Now the time that the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years, and it came about at the end of 430 years to the very day that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. So the author stops here to put things into perspective. It was 430 years ago that Jacob and his family came down to Egypt, and they had been in Egypt for that period of time. In my translation, it says, and it came about at the end of 430 years to the very day. It is argued that to the very day is probably not a good translation, that it's more likely to be on the same day when these other things that have been described occurred, on that very day. But if it's to that very day, then God is being very attentive to the calendar. And if he's being that attentive to the calendar, I suspect that there's symbolic value there. But it appears that he's not doing that. He's saying, on this day, then, when they did the Passover, that's the day they left, and that's 430 years after they first arrived. That fits what Abraham had said. He said, my descendants will go down to Egypt and be there for 400 years. Talked about that in Genesis 13 through 16. Okay. There are a number of things that I want to talk about that I think are interesting and or important as we go along. The first two are just tidying up some things. The word Passover is used in different ways in the Bible, and you have to be aware that it can be used in several different ways. Apparently, the etymology is actually uncertain, but it says in the text that it was called Passover because the Lord passed over the houses of the Israelites. It can refer to this original event in Egypt when the Israelites escaped the judgment on the Egyptians. So it can refer to that one specific event, that time. Secondly, it can refer to the celebration of that event. And in so doing, it can refer specifically to the first of the 7 days, or it can be used more loosely to refer to the whole spring festival, the whole spring feast, all 7 days. And fourthly, it can refer to the Passover lamb. The lamb itself can be called the Passover. So be aware that those are all possibilities for that particular word. Second thing, the first Passover was unique. Celebration of the Passover has varied over the years. There are changes that have been made in it over time. As I pointed out before, there's no indication that the Passover was celebrated while they were in the wilderness after the first anniversary of the Passover. So it may not have been celebrated at all during that period of time. Before there was a temple, the Passover was celebrated as a household feast. So people celebrated it at their homes. They killed the lamb there at their home and celebrated it in their house. Then, when the temple was built, and this could have started before, this could have started in association with the tabernacle, but we don't know for sure. But when the temple was built, we know that the Passover was celebrated at the temple. But interestingly, one component of the Passover celebration that was from the very beginning that's unique is that for Passover, it is the head of the household that brings the lamb into the temple, and it's the head of the household that kills the lamb. Then, after the destruction of the temple, there is no sacrifice of a Passover lamb. So there are changes that have taken place in the celebration over time, and these are just some of them. There are others as well. There are some distinctives of the first Passover, that is the Egyptian Passover, that are pointed out by the rabbis. The first is, on the first day of the Passover, the Israelites fled. So they didn't celebrate it as a Sabbath. It wasn't a rest day. They were on the run. Secondly, the rabbis argue that they ate unleavened bread only on the first day, and then later it's done for the whole week. I'm not sure on what basis they argue that. Thirdly, the blood sprinkled on the doorposts. That was done in the first Passover. That is not done after that, is what they argue. That is certainly true once they start performing the sacrifices in the temple. The blood is splattered on the altar rather than on the doorposts. And the first Passover, no one was allowed to leave the house that night. Later on, in the later celebrations, that is allowed. And lastly, the rabbis say that they ate standing up and ready to go in the first Passover. But after that, they eat reclining. And they argue that that's because when they were in Egypt, they ate as a slave, standing and ready to go. And after that, they ate as a freeman, reclining. Okay, Kay Smith wrote an email to me a few weeks ago asking a question that I had been thinking about and trying to sort out myself. So I want to take a little time to address it. And that is, when God told Moses and Aaron to go to Pharaoh, what he told them initially, what he told them to request, is that the people of Israel be allowed to go 3 days' journey to make sacrifices. And what Kay was asking is, how are we supposed to think about that? Was God lying? because God knew that he wanted them to go more than 3 days away. He wanted them to leave completely. So why is the request to Pharaoh that it be for a three-day journey to sacrifice to their Lord? We know from the text that the three-day journey to sacrifice to their God is important because for the Egyptians, it would have been abhorrent for foreigners to sacrifice to their own gods on Egyptian territory. So they have to go a distance far away enough that it's no longer going to bring some kind of blemish on the record of the Egyptians. And 3 days seems to have been that distance. We also know, and this is from archaeological data, that such a request was not without precedent. We know that there were workers who received permission to have time off to worship to their gods. Now, I don't know whether those were slaves or whether they were other workers. I don't know if those were Egyptians or if they were foreigners. But we know that there are workers who asked for time off to go worship their gods. There is another place where it records slaves who were allowed to miss work to sacrifice their gods. So presumably what was requested is not unprecedented. But why does God say to ask for a three-day trip so they can worship their God rather than say, just let us go? I have run into several explanations. The first one is one of three that's ventured by Ryken in his book, and that is that Moses was not obligated to tell the tyrant the truth. The second, and this one I can't remember, and I went back and looked and couldn't find it, but someplace, one of the commentators said that everyone understood that the request for 3 days off was actually a request for freedom. And I'm not sure on what basis that's justified because I couldn't find it. The third suggestion that I ran across is that this is typical Middle Eastern bargaining procedure, that you ask for something. Sometimes it goes the other way, bigger and then it gets smaller, but here it's smaller and it gets to be a bigger request. But in any case, it's part of that Middle Eastern bargaining procedure. And there are a couple of commentators that thought that that was the best explanation. The one that I have been inclined to is that God was making a lesser request to show that Pharaoh was so stubborn that he would not even do that. But either of those last two seemed to me to be plausible. In any case, Pharaoh and the Egyptians seem to assume that the Israelites are not coming back. By the time that the Israelites are leaving, everybody understands they're going for good. They aren't coming back. This is not a three-day trip into the wilderness. And he knew that there was the chance all along. He understood there was a chance that they would be going forever because he wanted them to leave something behind to force them to come back. In any case, as things unfolded, they leave as conquerors. And as conquerors, then, they have a right to their freedom. And that it would have been seen that way by everyone, that they are legitimately free by the customs of the ancient world. Okay, I said that that phrase at the end of verse 32 where Pharaoh says, and bless me also, I find that very haunting. He's been brought to his knees. He says, get out of here, go, get out of here, and bless me, ask for a blessing on me. I've pointed out before, Pharaoh is a conflicted person. He goes back and forth. When things are really miserable in the plagues, then he's ready to let them go. But as soon as he starts to release his grip on them a little bit, and he sees a way that he might be able to keep them, he pulls them back in. He doesn't want them to go. If Pharaoh is viewed as a bad guy, and I think that we are to see him that way in this narrative, what is the nature of his badness? The thing that jumps out is that he's stubborn. But stubbornness isn't inherently bad. Stubbornness can be good. Depends on what you're being stubborn about. Job is stubborn, for instance. But Pharaoh's stubbornness is born out of arrogance. And that's the thing that seems to be pinpointed in the text, is the arrogance of Pharaoh is the problem. He refuses to bow down to the God who is there. And God gave him lots of reason, lots of evidence that Yahweh is indeed the God of the universe, the one who is there. There were the signs, there were the plagues, and the plagues were predicted and then happened as predicted. But despite all of that evidence, he refuses to humble himself before God. He's willing to receive benefits from Yahweh if Yahweh will give them, but he's unwilling to be subservient to Yahweh. So what Pharaoh needs is humility, the kind of humility that recognizes that he, Pharaoh, is but a creature at the mercy of the Creator, to recognize that we're at God's mercy for absolutely everything, and that because of that, in all things, our attitude should be what Jesus' attitude was, not my will, but thy will be done in all things. And Pharaoh can't do that. And then one last thing that I think it's not in your notes, but I think this is very interesting and it's helpful for me, and it's stuff that we'll be talking about more as we proceed. But this last three verses where it talks about them being in Egypt for 430 years, that means that for 430 years they've been in Egypt. We don't know how long during that 430 years they were enslaved, but it really looks to me like the actions of Joseph, ironically, set things up for them to be enslaved in the near future after Joseph dies. And there are indications, I think, in the Joseph narrative that Joseph thinks bad things are coming in Egypt, that the stage is set for bad things to happen to the Hebrews. So they are probably oppressed for a long period of time, probably hundreds of years. And you can imagine they're enslaved and they're calling out to God for relief from their oppression for 430 years. And there's no indication, the text is silent, about anything that God did to mitigate that whatsoever. The first hint of hope is the birth of Moses. Moses is born. He is adopted by the Pharaoh's daughter. So he's in a position where he might be able to do something. But as we read in the text, that doesn't go so well. Moses tries to help his people out, tries to alleviate their suffering, but that doesn't happen. The people don't want his help, and he is forced to leave, and he goes off into the wilderness, and he's there for 40 years. And I'm convinced that the text is leading us to believe that even Moses has given up hope that he will play any role in helping the Israelites escape their oppression. But then Moses comes back 40 years later. He walks out of the desert into Egypt 40 years later. That's amazing. And then 8 months later, the Israelites are leaving Egypt. So for 430 years, nothing happens. Then in 1 year, they're out of there. God has a strange sense of time. For 430 years of crying out for release from their oppression, that's not too much to ask of people. For us, that seems like an eternity. But for him, he's got his purposes. He's got his reasons. But when he decides to act, in 8 months, they're out of there. It happens really fast. And then in the whole Exodus account, as we go on, God is very present and active. But after the Exodus and the conquest, there's a lot of dead time, a lot of silence. So there are long periods when you can't see God doing anything of significance, despite the cries and the requests from people for him to act. But when it's the right time, he acts. And when he acts decisively and quickly, very quickly. Okay, questions, comments?
About the Passover, you said it changed over time. Is there any place in the Old Testament where it actually requires that it be in the temple? Or is that kind of a religious kind of movement by religious people? It just seems like it a home kind of event and home feast makes sense, and that seems like what God intended. But then it becomes this big temple thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. In Deuteronomy, on several occasions, it talks about the feasts are supposed to be held at a central location.
Okay, yeah.
So that's part of what Deuteronomy is doing, is it's taking the law that was given on Mount Sinai, and it is making some adjustments to it so that it is suited for living in the land. And that's one of them. And then that's an interesting thing, and I suspect that there's symbolism in there that's important, that it moves from the household to the temple.
A ton of questions, but the one about the numbers, how many people. Now, originally, the Pharaoh looked across there and he saw enough people to feel threatened. These people, apparently they still saw themselves as not Egyptian. They possibly had kept their own language, their own tribal identities and whatnot. And he's saying, you know, they're not us. And there's a lot of, so let's start killing them. And yet they grew into a, at that time, they had grown into a population large enough to do all the work. Now, I'm not saying they had to be 600,000 men and families going out, but I'm not sure when I read history if Pharaoh, other than their the fear that they would ally themselves with an enemy, if Pharaoh needed to be afraid of that few people.
Well, first of all, even if the number's wrong, we don't know what the right number, what it would actually be. Mm. People have tried to guesstimate what that would be, and so that's where they come up with the 20 to 30,000. But
apparently they were few enough that they could migrate quickly. I can't imagine moving. When we moved troops into Iraq in the first war, it took a month to get 600,000 people in there, men, just men, with food and a place to sleep.
Right. And that's one of the things that's pointed out is 2 million numbers just cannot work in the text at all. It seems to me that it doesn't take a huge number of people to be disruptive in a society. We're seeing that now. I mean, terrorism is few people disrupting society. I don't think that when it talks about Pharaoh being concerned about them multiplying in numbers, first of all, I'm not convinced necessarily that he is actually afraid of the numbers. I think that that's his way of getting public support for his policies, but I'm not convinced that he is actually concerned about the numbers all that much. But if he is, I still think that if you have 30,000 slaves in your midst and they rise up against you, especially in a situation where you're being threatened from the outside by some other force, and that seems to be what he's concerned about, I think 30,000 is that's a significant number. I saw an estimate someplace, and I wish I could remember, an estimate of what Pharaoh's army would have been, and I think it's about 20,000, between 10 and 20,000. So we aren't talking about huge, huge armies at this time.
Yeah, when I read the accounts of Egypt's final battle with the Hittites, the numbers are huge, much larger than that, when they went north to strike.
Yeah. And the question is, are those numbers reliable?
Yeah. And the other question I had, and this is, I don't know why this is important to me, but when God says, I will go through the land of Egypt, I will execute judgment, I am the Lord, I will pass over you, I will strike the land of Egypt. And then it says, I will pass through to smite the Egyptians. But then he talks about the destroyer. I will not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to smite you. Mm-hmm. Is that a literary device to say death?
I'm assuming so.
Because we have this Cecil B. DeMille model of an angel of death.
Right.
And he's saying the death is the angel, the messenger of God's will here.
Mm-hmm. Right. I don't know exactly how to picture it, but my assumption has been that the angel of death is just a way of describing God's activity when he went through and killed firstborn. So I'm not inclined to see it as a separate person of some kind, but it could be. I don't know.
And the third thing I notice is that slave, your slave, who's been brought into your house and circumcised, can eat of the Passover, but not a hired servant, nor one who sojourns with you. Slaves had apparently they had slaves, which is kind of odd, and apparently they had their own flocks, which in modern times we would think would be strange for slaves to have wealth.
Where are you reading?
45.
Yeah, we'll get 45. To that next week.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll talk about that next week. But what you said reminds me of something that I need to mention. In verse 38, I forgot to point out that it says, and a mixed multitude also went up with them. And the mixed multitude is suggesting that this is not racially pure. So there were elements that left Egypt that were not descendants of Abraham. They were not Israelite. So presumably some Egyptians, and there could have been other people who were slaves in Egypt who went with the Israelites, who identified with the Israelites and went with them. And I think that's really interesting because we are seeing the formation of Israel as a people and as a culture, as a nation. And at this time, it's a mixed multitude already. And we'll see that there are other people that come in along the way as we go through history. So it's not bloodlines alone that are definitive of whether one is an Israelite or not.
Looking at the plagues from the perspective of a hypothetical universal God, one that created everything, the plagues appear to be very vindictive and all of the minutiae about the Passover also seems sort of OCD. And the textual problems appear very human.
What do you mean by that?
Just like what you would expect from a text that's a cultural product.
Okay.
So in contrast with this idea of a God that makes everything and is the source of the galaxies, you have this story about a vindictive OCD God, and there's textual problems that scholars quibble about for eons. It just doesn't rest well with me to consider that something to put my total trust in, but I'm interested in what you think.
Well, even in this text, there are suggestions along the way that we are not looking at a God who is purely wrathful and vindictive. As the plagues progress, they increase in their severity. Warnings are given, and yet Pharaoh refuses to recognize what's happening and recognize the God that's behind that. But why didn't God just come in and zap everybody immediately? He could have, if he's the God that's described here. But he didn't, and in fact, he doesn't kill all of the Egyptians even in the end. The Egyptians are allowed to go on and live as a race. So, and there are Egyptians join in with the Israelites and leave with them. So there are elements of grace that are scattered throughout this. But I think what the picture that we're supposed to get is that God is a just God. He is our creator. And to the extent that we are rebellious against him, that is a problem that he will deal with. He'll be very patient and long-suffering. He's going to give people lots of chance. But at some point, that judgment will come. And I think that this is that kind of thing. This is that kind of judgment. And as I'm understanding it, this is just a trial run for a greater judgment yet to come that will be grander, that is, in scope, and where God really lowers the boom on the rebelliousness in the world against him.
Given that he hardens Pharaoh's heart, isn't that kind of vindictive?
As you go through the text, in the early parts, it's Pharaoh who hardens his heart, if you watch the wording. And then as time goes on, it switches to God hardened his heart more frequently. And that's a big conversation about what is the relationship between my free will as a human being and God's sovereignty? And that gets complicated. But I'm not bothered by that, but I've worked through that kind of issue. And if you haven't worked through it, then it is an issue. I can understand that's an issue. But that's a long conversation.
I guess the last thing, just to wrap this up, that I would try to get some feedback about would be that the textual problems, possible corruptions, are the kinds of things that you would expect from a text that's a cultural product rather than something that comes from the source of an almighty, all-powerful God that could control for those kinds of things. If you have a deity who can produce initially an original text that is infallible, then couldn't that deity keep that text infallible and without error? Mm-hmm. So,
and my answer to that would be is absolutely yes, he could. But what's really interesting to me is the extent to which God kind of, he lets us run with things. I mean, he lets us do our thing. And yet he's working in history constantly, but we are making our own choices and decisions. We put a very human spin on everything we do. And nevertheless, God is doing his thing. And ultimately, that's a very divine thing that comes out of that.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks.